is a little bit too far. It's a step too far, and that's the problem. And one whitey white.
AC2IS query.
Go ahead, AC2IS.
AC2SHO is coming. I heard that there were additional issues here. The 737 MAX has different engines. There are high bypass engines, which I believe makes them larger, shifts the center of gravity of the airplane, and necessitates this additional feature. Maybe you'd call it a safety feature, the one that pushes the nose of the aircraft down in the event that the angle of attack is too high. That system is prone to either is intended to fix or is prone to an additional problem called trim runaway. And then let me break for a second before completing the statement before I make a question. My understanding is that the addition of this engine necessitated that feature to make the plane safe to fly. Yes, Boeing wanted to say that it was essentially the same plane. Every pilot could fly it. Therefore, there was essentially no additional training for the 737 MAX that had this feature. When training was really required, it seems like this is a feature, a system that could be disabled under dire circumstances, and the pilots in this instance were not aware of that or how to disable the system or possibly if it was present. But the real question is, isn't this sort of a change in philosophy for Boeing to have a system like this that effectively can override the pilot's decisions of, you know, where the control surfaces of the plane should be moving based on the stick input? Prior, you know, the philosophy was the pilot was always in control, and this is sort of more of a undisclosed autopilot-like feature that does not get disabled with the autopilot. Is that a correct assessment, AC2IS?
AC2IS and one YDY. It's a bit more complex, and you're conflating a number of issues, some of which you're simply lumping together, some of which you're putting the cart before the horse. Very simply, the airplane, in order to have higher fuel efficiency, needed a bigger engine, physically larger engine, not more thrust, although it did have more thrust. Physically larger in diameter by about 20 inches. In order to accommodate this 20 diameter change, you know, 10 inch diameter radius change, or 10 inch radius change, they moved the engine further forward on the wing pylons, redesigned the wing pylons to allow them to be slightly further forward, and because they were slightly further forward, they were slightly higher, but more importantly, they also had a greater turning moment, so when they were producing high power settings, they were likely to pitch the nose up. Let me drop for a second. Now you have an engine that has got a greater capability to pitch the nose up, and in order to compensate for that, they install this other device called MCAS that says, oops, if your nose is too high, I'm going to pitch down. Seems like a reasonable concept. The problem is that MCAS does two things. First, that are undesirable. First, when it starts to pitch down, when you release the stab trim, the manual stab trim, which is a couple of pickle switches located on either yoke, when you release these switches and it resets, it wasn't smart enough to know that it was resetting to an already displaced position. So it kept thinking it was only moving the aircraft a little bit, or the stab trim a little bit. Second, the aircraft as produced ended up with much greater stabilizer trim authority than what Boeing initially told the FAA they were going to build. Third, the pitch trim runaway that you started to discuss was incorporated or not rediscussed. Now, when pitch trim runaway is taught, it's something that normally pilots, a captain will see at least once a year in one of the two biennial or one of the two flight reviews that a captain gets. The co-pilot gets a sim check once a year, the captain gets it once every 6 months, and usually the captain gets a stab kit trim runaway in one of his 2 6-month checks. Let me drop. And so we've talked about the stab trim runaway, we've talked about the MCAS, the philosophy difference. And the philosophy issue was that when Boeing built it, their concept was when you disengage autoflight, the pilot's flying the airplane. And for some reason, when they added this to the manual flight or the stab trim system, which is essentially part of the manual flight system, it simply wasn't perceived as being a completely separate thing. And that was a failure. Now, let's talk about software. The big software issue is that the aircraft has to know that MCAS has been activated and that the pilot has made some counter activation or counter flight control input in the direction opposite to what MCAS is saying. And that's the software revision in a nutshell that they're working on. When they get that fixed up or straightened out, we'll see something different coming from Boeing. Unfortunately, also, you know, then you have the whole marketing department issue, and that's a, you know, conflicting but contributing aspect to this.
Bravo Zulu with one final question.
Answered the question for the last guy. Was that AIS still? Did I answer your question, sir?
Yes, this is Bill AC2IS. I think you did. I had heard that there was this cumulative problem with this system and the you're calling it the stab trim system. I'm not familiar with the stab term. But I wasn't sure that was correct, but I guess you're saying that it is, that this system that pitches the nose down sort of cumulatively over time has an increasing effect every time it engages, which seems like a bad idea. One other thing is this feature to compare pitch inputs, I'm guessing that it's part of a package that includes a lot of things and that it's not a one-off feature that can be bought. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Well, it's not part of a one-off thing. It's part of how the MAX 8 and the MAX 9 accommodated these engines, which were larger in diameter and mounted further forward relative to the wing, what's called mean aerodynamic cord, and therefore can have a greater pitch-up trim input when they're at high thrust settings, high PLA, power level ankle settings. So all these things, you know, are a series of errors that are, I'm sure, being examined and won't occur again, but nonetheless, physically there.
This is AC2IS. I do understand that the system that I think you're calling MCAS is a necessary part of the MAX 737 MAX because of the larger engine. But the additional optional safety feature we're talking about is, you know, comparing the pitch input that goes to that MCAS versus some other pitch indicator that goes to some other system, and that extra feature that compares those two pitch inputs, I'm guessing that feature to compare those two inputs and give you a warning if they disagree is not available as an individual purchase, but is part of a package. Is that correct, AC2IS?
C2IS, N1YDY. I don't think I've been specific or clear enough. This is not a package, an individual component issue. This is the aircraft back in the 60s was designed with certain parts. As time went on, they added more parts, took some parts away, and this thing called MCAS is now a basic part of the MAX 8 and the MAX 9 aircraft. The additional thing would be some type of cockpit indication that says, hey, you've got a difference in angle of attack vane position sensing and therefore in the inputs to the MCAS. But the airplane doesn't come with the option of buying MCAS or not. You're going to get it. The aircraft, and you should be able to recognize what it is and how to use it. Unfortunately, Boeing kind of wanted to make the aircraft seem as if it's just another aircraft in the 737 family, and they neglected to provide all the data about it to the airlines, and therefore the airlines did not provide the data to their flight crews for training. The flight crews knew that there was a stabilizer trim system. They knew how it worked. They knew a number of different things. Unfortunately, what they didn't know was how the aircraft might have this MCAS, which would automatically activate, and that this system would activate at a least opportune time. But they should have recognized once it did activate that it was just a regular pitch trim runaway issue and dealt with it accordingly. Good. Any other questions?
To Bravo Zulu, I just one final question. Are you aware of any studies that compared the fatalities of the Airbus type of systems and the Boeing type of systems?
Yes, I am. And to make your answer as simple as possible, they're essentially the same. It's what happens when things really go bad that differentiates one type of system from another, but in fact, on the they're essentially similar fatality or actually considered a safety rate for what's called per 100,000 aircraft seat miles flown.
AC2IS, you mentioned that this the situation looks like a quote unquote standard trim runaway situation. So what should a pilot do in this quote unquote standard trim runaway situation, AC2IS?
Good question. Normally what you do is you disengage the autopilot, which is one of the buttons on the yoke. You then attempt to over-control or overpower the step trim in the opposite direction. So let's say it's rolling the nose down. When I say rolling the nose down, by the way, there are two big wheels in the cockpit, one on either side of the pedestal that both pilots see. They're by their knees. And these things are spinning when this system is activated. So there's no doubt in their mind that this thing's going. you can't sleep through this. It's loud, and it, you know, there's a physically device that's spinning. If your knee's in the wrong place, it can hit you. You're not going to misunderstand that this is occurring. So this thing starts to move. You try to overcompensate or over-control it in the opposite direction by using the pickle switches in the opposite direction. If that doesn't work, there are two switches located on the lower right of the pedestal, and you pull these two switches or turn these two switches depending upon, I don't want to say turn, I want to say toggle. Toggle these two switches depending upon who built the airplane and when. In the Douglas DC-9/MD-80 series of aircraft that I used to fly, you pull the thing, and in this system you run the switches in the opposite direction. But it should disconnect the system at that time. Now, this is where I talked about the reset and the MCAS not being smart enough to know, okay, I pitched it down and the pilot's pitched it up, and now I'm going to pitch it down again, and the pilot has to go through that whole thing once again. So now what happens is the next thing they do is they have to fly the aircraft manually, overrun these spinning wheels.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Thank you. Timed out right after you said override the spinning wheels.
I'm doing this 2 for 2. I guess I should practice more with the repeater. So the wheels are spinning in the in whatever direction. So in this case, they're spinning nose down. So you're going to try to override these spinning wheels. First thing you're going to do is you're going to try to grab the wheel. That doesn't work. You're going to use the pitch trim cutout switches in the lower right side of the pedestal or the quadrant between the two pilots. While somebody is doing that, the other guy is going to look for the three AC circuit breakers that are associated with the pitch trim motor. There's a three-phase AC motor that spins a jack screw. The jack screw turns in something called a gimbal nut, which is just a big greased thing that, because of the inclination of the screw threads of the jack screw, it causes this nut to run up or down on a stabilizer, and that causes the leading edge of the stabilizer to move up or down. In this case, it's moving up in order to pitch the nose down. These circuit breakers each control a single phase of the 400 cycle, 115/208, 208 volt system. So you have to pull each of these three circuit breakers in order to depower this motor.
AC2IS, I guess we're saying that in both of these crashes then, the pilots either did not pull these three circuit breakers or did not know that that was an option available to them. Is that right? AC2IS.
Well, I certainly wasn't in either of those cockpits. It's the way it looks at this time. It's the way they found the position of the gimbal nut on the jack screw in both aircraft.
Is that correct? AC2IS.
Sorry, you doubled with somebody else. Could you say again, AC2IS?
It sounds to me like you're saying that the position of the gimbal nut indicates that these circuit breakers had not been pulled. Is that correct? AC2IS.
Must recognize that I am not privy to NTSB investigation at this time, but that is my perception of what has occurred. I heard somebody else in there. If AC2IS is done, there was another station that had a question.
Yeah, my apologies. I'm on the IRLD, so it's a little tough to get in and get a comment. But my comment is, there was a headline I read, and I apologize I didn't get into the article, that there was a flight where they recorded that someone in the jump seat instructed the pilots to do something that saved that flight from having the same issue. I was wondering if you'd comment on that. Is it real and what happened? This is KC2SHO in Los Alamos.
I read that, and my understanding is that, you know, you had a third person in the jump seat who was familiar with the aircraft, and because he wasn't physically wrestling with the controls when all this occurred, he was able to put his in, and the two guys who were actually flying were able to act on it. You know, it becomes quite high stress when the airplane starts doing things you're not expecting, and that's part of the problem. So by having this third person, they were able to get an input or a suggestion that, you know, they simply hadn't thought of themselves.
That was the solution. Sorry, I didn't pause. And that was the solution you just described?
It led them down the path to get to that solution. Yes, that's correct.
This is KC2SHO.
Anyone else before I give it back to Roy?
So, yeah, this is something else I'd heard, that this trim runaway situation had happened on flights in the U.S., and that I guess it was considered to be by pilots a serious issue, but for whatever reason was not addressed. Is that correct? AC2IS.
Now you're getting into stuff that's a little above my pay grade. I've heard this. I understand what you're asking, and it's been my understanding that you're correct, but I don't have proof for one way or the other that that's what occurred. I've certainly heard it from others, but I've never actually had somebody sit down with me and say, Hank, you know, I saw this the other day when we went into this airport or that airport. So I have heard it, but I have no proof. And just one more comment. The fact that we're hearing about pilots doing it in the U.S., experiencing that problem, and getting on the ground and complaining about it is indicative of the mindset and training difference between what the U.S. demands and what the rest of the world sometimes accepts for training and safety.
The flight yoke in a particular direction, that seems kind of low-tech to me, I guess, or something. It seems to me that you know, that there would just be sort of an electronic input someplace, but I guess having electronics just change things would be making the plane more fly-by-wire. But it seems odd that the solution should be implemented by essentially pushing on the flight yoke with a motor. What's your impression of that, AC2IS?
All right. I doubled with you in the beginning, so I didn't hear most of your question. I was talking myself. If you want to repeat the beginning of it, if I can take a guess, I think you were saying something about the fact that you think it seems a little archaic to be have an electrical motor pushing on the yoke. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, that's what I was saying. It seems kind of maybe old school, but maybe it's preserving sort of the integrity of the flight system, and, you know, by not having something else in line with the flight controls or the flight yoke and control surfaces, that would be an additional point of failure. You know, maybe this kind of a system is somehow safer, but it does seem kind of old school. You would think that you know, planes of this size would essentially be fly-by-wire already, and that systems like this would be implemented somehow electronically instead of mechanically, AC2IS.
Even as it's already fly-by-wire, at some point, it's still a physical airplane, and the control input forces that are required are still quite high, and you need to have enough control that, or enough force to force the flight control to move in the direction that you want. So whether or not it's a hydraulic system, you know, the Airbuses are notorious for having these fly-by-wire systems, but in fact what they're doing is they're moving hydraulic valves and moving things that way. So whether or not your system is electrically controlled or hydraulically controlled, you're still using a tremendous amount of power that has to be sourced from somewhere, something, in order to move the flight controls, if that answers your question.
I guess, so you're telling me that in Boeing systems, it's kind of like a car with power steering. It'd be a hydraulic assist, but for certain maneuvers, the amount of force you have to have on the flight yoke is still quite significant. Meaning that if the hydraulic assist failed entirely, you could potentially muscle your all your flight surfaces where you needed them to be. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Okay, I heard another station. But to get back to AC2IS, the issue is, well, Mike in the right place. The issue is that you need to have enough power to operate the flight controls. There are plenty of airplanes out there where if you don't have hydraulic or electrical power, you simply can't fly the aircraft. There's no way to muscle your way through it. In fact, some of the aircraft that have hydraulic flight controls have what they call artificial pitch or artificial field. An artificial field is a bunch of springs that are designed to allow the pilot to think that the control is moving back to a position that it would have if he'd been flying a smaller airplane that had no assist. And with that, let me turn to the next guy who had jumped in and ask him what his question was. This is N1YDY. There was nobody there. Maybe that was my error. N1YDY with AC2IS. Do you have any other questions, sir, or can we put it out for general discussion?
Yes, I would. All right, changing radios here. I guess I would ask if this Boeing 737 is one where it could be flown without, you know, hydraulics if hydraulics failed, AC2IS.
I have to ask a guy who flies a 7-3 for a living. I know that there's an A and B system for the rudder power pack and the rudder control, and they've had trouble with the rudder system in the past in different places, but I'm really not sure if you can manually fly the aircraft with no hydraulics for the rudder. Now, when I used to fly the older MD-80/DC-9s, you didn't actually fly the control surfaces, you just flew the trim tabs, and the trim tabs would then fly the control surfaces in the direction you wanted. As a result, especially with the DC-9, it was a fingertip aircraft. You used your index finger and your forefinger, and you used your thumb, and with those three fingers, you flew the airplane once you were comfortable with it and you knew what to expect and blah, blah, blah.
Okay, I think those are all the questions I have on the 737 MAX. Thanks very much, AC2IS.
It's always a pleasure for me to talk about airplanes. So, I'm always willing to, and when I don't know, I'll hopefully tell you. and be smart enough to recognize it, I don't know. But for the most part, you know, it's in the type of airplane we were talking about, my level of experience is commensurate with what we're discussing. All right, so John, I think it's, I'm sorry, Roy, I think it's back to you, sir, and one YDY.
Okay, thanks a lot, Hank. I really appreciate it. It was very informative. Learned a lot. I'm sure a lot of other people listening learned a lot as well. So thank you very much, Hank.
You're always welcome, sir.
So, anyone have anything to say about this particular topic, or if Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, who's he was going to come back at 10:40, came back 5 minutes. Either case, please push the talk button. Very well, on to the next topic. Well, as I've often mentioned, I find many YouTube videos to be very entertaining and informative. And one of the best series, in my humble opinion, is a series called Veritasium, hosted by an Australian-born scientist by the name of Derek Mueller. He has made some very entertaining YouTubes in the past regarding the findings in the following story as well, and I urge you to watch it when you have the time. I will place a link up to it on my webpage, roy.ac2gs, so you can see it at your leisure. Apparently, the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field, a trait as magnetical reception, is well documented among many animals, but researchers have struggled to show that humans are also capable of this feat until now. New experimental evidence published just this week in science journal eNeuro suggests that the human brain is capable of responding to the Earth's magnetic field, although at an unconscious level. It's not clear if our apparent ability to sense the magnetic field is in any way useful, as it's likely a vestigial trait left over from our more primitive past. Given the new findings, however, researchers will investigate further to determine if magnetoreception is somehow contributing to our behavior or abilities, such as our spatial orientation. Let me drop for a sec. Magnetoreception is found among both invertebrates, and it's probably a capacity that's been around for a very long time. Now, some bacteria and protozoan also exhibit magnetoreception, as do some migratory birds and sea turtles, who use the added sense to assist with navigation. Dogs are also sensitive to the Earth's magnetic field, orienting their bodies along the north-south axis when they apparently defecate. I have not experimentally proven that, though. Around 30 years ago, scientists tried to determine if humans have a similar capacity, but to no avail. Those pioneering efforts produced results that were either inconclusive or unreproducible. So scientists largely gave up hearing magnetoreception as something outside the human realm. In the years that followed, work on animals increasingly pointed to magnetoreception as the result of a complex neurological processing. A possibility that motivated the Caltech geophysicists to revisit this issue. Their approach was to focus on brainwave activity alone. If the brain is not responding to the magnetic field, then there's no way that the magnetic field can influence someone's behavior, is the thought. The brain must first perceive something in order to act on it. There is no such thing as extrasensory perception. What they have shown is that this is proper sensory system in humans, just like it is in many animals. To test whether the human brain is capable of magnetoreception, and to do so in a reliable, believable manner, the scientists set up a rather elaborate experiment involving a chamber specially designed to filter out any extraneous interference that might influence the result. Let me drop for a second. The isolated chamber within, which participates had their brainwaves monitored by electroencephalogram, was housed inside a Faraday cage, which shielded all interior contents from external electromagnetic fields. Three orthogonal sets of square coils called Merrick coils allowed the researchers to control the ambient magnetic field around the participants' heads. Acoustic panels on the walls reduced external noise from the building, While a wooden chair and isolated floor prevented any unwanted interference, it coiled. A battery-powered electroencephalogram was placed next to the participant, which was connected to a computer in another room with an optical fiber cable. During carefully controlled experiments, participants sat upright in the chair with their hands positioned near the center of the magnetic field, while electroencephalogram data was collected from 64 electrodes. The hour-long tests in which the direction of the magnetic fields were rotated repeatedly were performed in total darkness. Now, the experiment involved 34 volunteers who collectively participated in hundreds of these trials. All tests were done in a double-blind manner, and control groups were also included. Let me drop for a second. After the experiments, none of the participants said that they could tell when or any change to the magnetic field had occurred. But for four of the 34 participants, the electroencephalogram data told a completely different story. As noted in the new study, the researchers recorded a strong, specific human brain response to stimulated rotation of the Earth's strength magnetic field. Specifically, the magnetic stimulation caused a drop in the amplitude of the electroencephalogram alpha waves between 8 and 13 hertz, a response shown to be repeatable among these four participants, even months afterwards. Two simple rotations of the magnetic field appeared to trigger the response, movements comparable to a person nodding their head up or down or turning it from right to left. The alpha rhythm is the dominant brain wave produced by neurons when individuals aren't processing any specific sensory information or performing any specific task. When stimulus is suddenly introduced and processed by the brain, the alpha rhythm generally decreases. The authors wrote, "The drop in alpha waves observed during these experiments suggests that the brain interpreted the magnetic fields as some kind of stimulus, the neurological purpose or result of which is unclear. But as the new study pointed out, this observation now provides a basis to start the behavioral exploration of human magnetoreception." Let me drop for a second. The researchers don't know how the human brain is able to sense magnetic fields, but they have a favorite theory. There may be specialized sensory cells that contain tiny magnetite crystals, which is currently the only theory that explains all of the results and for which there is direct physiological data in animals. Back in 1992, these same scientists isolated crystals of biogenic magnetite from human brains, so they may be onto something. Other researchers should now dive into this possibility to flesh this idea out. Magnetoreception is a normal sensory system in animals, just like vision, hearing, touch, taste, smell, gravity, temperature, and many others. All of these systems have specific cells that detect the photons, sound waves, or whatever that send signals from them to the brain, as does a microphone or video camera connect to a computer. But without the software in the computer, the microphone or the video camera will not work. The scientists propose that human neurophysiology evolved with that magnetometer, most likely based on magnetite, and the brain has an extensive bit of software to process those signals. Looking ahead, these scientists would like to better understand the biophysics of this capacity, including measuring threshold sensitivities. They believe that it might be possible to bring magnetoreception into conscious awareness, a possibility that could spawn entirely new directions of research. Imagine, for example, if a human being had a built-in compass allowing them to sense magnetic noise. Let me drop for a sec. For the first time in humans, clear responses to magnetic field changes were observed. Even though the magnetic field was not consciously perceived in the test subjects that showed brain response to the field, the study invites other scientists to follow up research to understand the mechanism by which the magnetic field elicited neuronal activity. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WHYY, I'm still listening. I just couldn't transmit when you mentioned I call us at 10:35. Now I can transmit. When you're done, I have a question for you.
Okay, Joe. When we're done with this, assuming anyone has any questions about this subject, otherwise we'll move on to you.
C2IS, query.
Yes, Bill.
I had heard something about it being possible to trigger a quote-unquote out-of-body experience with an MRI machine, and that with certain people this is fairly repeatable. Do you think what you're describing now is or could be somehow related to that, AC2IS?
I mean, in the most broadest concern, I don't think it was actually an MRI. What happened is they've done experiments where they put very powerful electromagnets close to the skull and run them up as high as they can, and by doing them in certain areas in the on the surface of the skull, you can induce a current below it in the brain and activate all kinds of very interesting circuits that are kind of hardwired into us. We seem to have a kind of God center, if you will, which triggers a sense of agency. You get this kind of universal consciousness sensation, I'm told. So that's slightly different than the MRI, but it's in the same vein. This is a much more unconscious, where we have no way of tapping in at this point to these things that we can see registered as an electroencephalogram change. It's on a completely unconscious level that we right now don't seem to have access to. Other questions or comments about this particular story? I guess it's time for your question, Joe. What would you like to ask?
W2OY. The question has nothing to do with what you're talking about currently. It's just a physics type of question, and I really don't know the answer to it because I'm not good in this particular area, all right? I'll just give it to you anyway, and you can analyze it, and maybe you know the answer, maybe you can take a good guess, all right? It has to do with gas, a type of gas called methane, which is used in many businesses and homes. It's called natural gas. All right, say you have a condition, and this gas is at a pressure of approximately 1 to 1.5, maybe 2 pounds, after it goes through a regulator, which reduces it from the street pressure, which is much, much higher. And you have a leak in a pipe, and your sensing equipment held at that leak in the pipe can give you an indication of, say, 8% mixture of methane, which is in the lethal explosive level. How much would you measure if you moved that measuring equipment about 6 inches away from the leak? And you have, this is, say, done indoors, you have nothing blowing, no wind blowing, nothing, so you just have a cloud being produced from this methane gas, which is about something like 0.6 of air, so it'll tend to sort of rise like helium does. Back to you.
Okay, so basically it's the diffusion of a gas in regular air. At what point does it drop below the threshold of your detection device? Life in general, unfortunately, is complicated, so there's turbulence that will screw up any theoretical construct. But just based on a more theoretical concept, it probably diminishes according to the same inverse square law that a lot of things going in through three-dimensional space give. So, roughly speaking, it would decrease with 1 over r squared, whatever that would be, depending upon how many pounds per square inch pressure and what's the partial pressure and other such factors. So I wish I could give you a specific number of inches away from your leak, but that would be the underlying principle as I see it, except that turbulence would add a whole bunch of other little complications to that.
Okay. Anyway, have you been taking a guess at what you think that number would go to, say if you measured, like I said, say 8 to 10%. I think LEL, it's called a lethal explosive level for natural gas, is something like between 5% and 15%. So say you measure something right in the middle, between 8 to 10%. You couldn't even guess at what you think you'd measure at, say, 6 inches away with that same instrument, instead of being held right at the joint itself where it's leaking.
Personally, right here, right now, I probably wouldn't hazard a guess because I couldn't really do a good conversion from how much pressure is, you know, one pound per watt, 1 pound per inch, square inch, square millimeter, square centimeter, and I'm sure there must be calculating equations out there where you can plug things in and get rough approximations, but off the top of my head, I just don't have that ability to convert pressures into percentages of partial pressure.
Quebec, Golf Zulu.
Yes, Golf Zulu.
Rebuild on the B2QG set. I have a little bit of, I'll call it seat of my pants experience doing this. Fire service. So you respond to a a gas leak someplace and you try to locate it. So LEL is low explosive limit, and that's in other words, you can have a concentration below which below that number it won't explode, and above that number it won't explode. So you have to have the correct mixture in oxygen with air. So you have basically 100 graduations. You have 0% LEL to 100% LEL. And in that scale, it's very difficult to find a leak because you have pretty big steps. Drop. One of the meters I used for finding gas leaks and stuff had am I in trouble scale of LEL to say, okay, I shouldn't be here. And then it had sort of a diagnostic scale where it gave me something like 12,800 steps of resolution. And in that mode, I could go right to the specific, flexible line in the exact fryer in the kitchen that has 12 fryers and tell you exactly where in that line it was leaking pretty quickly. It really led you right there. Trying to do it by LEL is kind of clunky. LEL tells you if you're in trouble. Finding it, there's other devices that have different graduations of sensitivity, if that makes sense.
Makes sense to me. What about you, Joe? Do you have any kind of questions related to this that you might ask them?
Well, in one case, I was using a measurement device that goes from 0 to 100% LEL. And when it goes over 100% LEL, first of all, it'll give me an alarm. It'll give me an indication above like 15-20% or something like that. When it goes over 100%, then it gives you triggers another alarm that says, like, get out of the area, leave the area. I think 100% LEL is supposed to be the lowest level in percentage of gas. Unless I'm incorrect as far as how I understood it, like about 5% gas to air mixture. That's 100% LEL. And between there to 15% is your range of where the gas can ignite from a, some sort of an ignition source can ignite it and it'll burn. Above that, it doesn't burn. Below that, it doesn't burn. But what my question was, if you're measuring 8% gas, which is above the lowest number of 5%, and this is done by somebody else with a different type of meter, on a different range, what would you measure at, say, 6 inches away instead of measuring it right at the pipe joint itself where it's coming from? That was my basic question.
QGZ, let me see if I got it. Okay. All I was trying to communicate was that with, if you're measuring something on a scale of 0 to 100% LEL, most devices will kind of alert you at somewhere between 10 and 20% LEL. It may not be significantly different. You only have 100 steps. And the practical aspect of trying to measure with a meter giving you solely LEL is bound to be not have a lot of resolution and be a little unpredictable. I'm sure it's possible to calculate the exact concentration, but, you know, my experience is when you're using the meter in the LEL position, you're gonna have a pretty big area of 5% and a pretty big area of 6%, you know, if that makes sense, right? So, can't help you as far as calculating, but I can tell you doing it by LEL is going to be challenging.
See, where all this comes from is being instructed or told to use a pinicometer measuring device, which has, I think, has a sensitivity about 10 parts per million, and move this about 6 inches over a pipe and move it about 1 foot per second, something of that kind of rate. And I brought up the fact that the thing is not going to easily find gas leaks, where if you hold it next to each pipe joint, you have a much better chance of finding a leak, especially specifically. May not be a serious leak, but that was my question. What are you actually measuring at 6 inches away, moving it at a rate of, say, like 1 foot per second? But I guess that's too complex to calculate that out, even for the physics professor here.
So, yeah, what I would do is once I found gas, I would soapy water up the nearest joints and see if it's bubbling. That's pretty much it. With the limitation of what you have, I'd say that's how I find it, right?
Well, that's normally what's done anyway. You know, that's normally what's done. Different groups of people are doing different things, but I was sort of brought up more as a curiosity type of question, per se, of actually, you know, measuring something close up. It's like, you know, I guess taking an RF reading off some sort of RF emitting device. You hold something right next to it, you're going to get a certain reading. You hold a device a couple inches away or a foot away, the reading is going to diminish because of the inverse square law factor.
I would hazard to guess that what's going on here is, again, turbulence and the direction of the leak. If the leak is in the opposite direction and you stick it right next to the pipe, you may actually miss it. It might skirt past it. So I think what they're factoring in with the 6 inches of distance is to give the turbulence enough opportunity to mix and diffuse and improve your chances of getting... of not getting false negatives with your reading.
Or not finding a leak at all. Okay, very good.
Yeah, that's my best guess about that. Really haven't done that in the field, so don't know. And it's probably deeply problematic when you really start to crunch numbers and such, because again, there's a lot of turbulence that goes on in small scale. As it goes farther and farther away from the gas leak site, it tends to diffuse and become a statistical thing that's somewhat more predictable.
Okay, very good. Nothing more on this topic. I have nothing else for this evening, and I'll just go back to the listening mode. Thank you very much. Thank you, YYY.
Okay, Joe, you're welcome. As always, it's coming up to 10:59, almost 11 o'clock, so let me wrap it up here by reminding everyone that if you have any questions or topics or what the hell, if you have any puzzlers, because I always can use some more puzzlers, the email address to get me at is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And almost immediately after I release this switch here, I will post all the links to all the stories and the YouTubes and all the fun stuff on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, I want to thank Dick, I want to thank Paul, I want to thank Hank, and everyone who participated in tonight's little science talk, and hopefully we'll all be back to do it all over again next Sunday. So I'll pass it back to Dick to pass it over to Paul. On second thought, I guess I'll just pass it directly to...
Okay, very good. Thanks, Roy, for all of that.
Very
good. And, puzzles are always good. Very good. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report.
9125. You can listen to the broadcast.
Make sure, I'm not doubling it. Okay, I guess we're doing okay. Very good. First topic we have to do with the space war. We had the one. In the beginning of April. All on the American side. Russian space war station. But for now, we're just by Nick Hague and McLean. They went out to change. Ongoing program. They've decided on the international the existing nickel hydrogen back hooked up to the station since station. It's time for them to be changed out. They really had a tense and that time frame is over. Station started going up in, 1998, and some of the...
...being arrogant. You may also begin measuring your worth and identity as a
...3 to 2004. So it's time to change them out. They're going to change over to... And these are very big batteries. What you have is these... 240 feet long. And you know, they also go in, you know, they oppose one another when they roll out.
And that is the parable of covetousness.
In the middle, they meet at this truss section. And each truss section, you know, it could be, 20 feet long, and the truss section could be usually around 14 feet, wide. And they support the solar panels, and on the solar panels, right when they connect to the truss, they have compartments, and the compartments hold these batteries. The ones that exist up there are probably around 500, 600 pounds.
The cars they drive, the houses they buy.
Well, anyway, these batteries that exist, there's 48 of these massive batteries.
We should become more giving to the cars.
They're replacing with lithium ion batteries, which are roughly around 10,000 pounds. So they had there's different sections.
four main, so you have four solar panel sections where they come down. So you have two on the port side and two on the starboard side.